of a genetic makeup, which is connected to how the DNA strands create cells, which is create the body. If there is a genetic disorder, there are two possibilities. Either it's dominant, which means that it will always appear. And we can imagine sort of an alim, it's called the alim gevar. So that would be a violent genetic disorder. And there's a recessive genetic disorder. We see recessive genetic disorders. Well, a genetic disorder means, a recessive genetic disorder, is we have two people, both of whom are carriers. Most of the common thing we have, let's say, Tay-Sachs. So we have a genetic propensity to Tay-Sachs, which we call a carrier. So if we have mother and father who are both carriers, that means they're not ill, they are carriers. They will give some of their genetic material to their offspring. If both of them give healthy genetic material, then we will have a quarter of that, all of those children, but a quarter of the time, the children will be well. We'll go through, we'll understand in a moment how that works out. If mother gives bad genetics or father gives bad genetics, we're going to have a carrier, not an ill. We're going to have a child who will be the same as parent. Half of his genetics will be ill genetics. He'll be a carrier. And statistically, they're going to have a quarter of their children will have both bad genes of parents, and therefore they will be ill. So statistically in this family, they will have, if they have four children, statistically, one is healthy, two are carriers, and one is ill. That's how a recessive genetic disorder works. That's how Tay-Sachs works, sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, etc., etc. Canavans, blooms, etc. So what we are testing, when we are testing, when Do Yesharim are testing two carriers. So if mother is carrier, but father is not carrier, or the opposite, the relevance of having a sick child is zero. You will never have a sick child unless both parents are carriers. So only if both parents are carriers is it problematic. That's what Do Yesharim checks. It takes a blood sample and checks, is mother carrier or potential? Is chatan carrier and kala carrier? If they are, then that is a bad match because some of their children will be ill. But if one of them is a carrier and the other one is not, then that has no relevance to being healthy or ill. That's not 100% true, but that's true in most recessive genetic disorders.
Why is it that when both are carriers, why isn't it that boys and children are ill?
Because when both are carriers, they are giving part of their genetic material. Okay, the child will potentially get part from mother and part from father. A carrier means that half of my genes, it doesn't work out that way, but half of the genes are healthy and half are unhealthy. When the child is born, or before the child is conceived, we don't know whether he's going to get healthy-healthy, healthy-ill, ill-healthy, or ill-ill. That's how it works out, pans out genetically. And therefore, in a dominant genetic disorder, he will always be ill. But in a recessive genetic disorder, one that only appears when there's a full genetic cohort, then he will be, only in that case, will be ill. Okay, so let's take one example. We could spend a long time, we don't have the time today, and look in every single genetic disorder. But let's look at cystic fibrosis, CF, which is one of the things that Do Yesharim do check. Okay, one of the things that Do Yesharim checks is CF, cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is related to certain development, limb development, muscle development. How common is it? In Ashkenazim, in Greece, in Bulgaria, in Georgia, in Libya, it's 1 in 2,500 people is ill. Okay? In Turkey, Tunisia, it's 1 by 5,000. In Egypt, Yemen, it's 1 by 8,000. In Morocco, it's 1 by 15,000.
General population or Jewish population?
General population. But we see that it's a similarity. You know what? It might even be Jewish population. I think it's Jewish population. Sorry, Jewish population. Because it was a study done in Israel of the Jewish population that came from Libya to Morocco, it's 1 in 15,000. Iran, 1 in 32,000. Iraq, 1 in 39,000. So here we see, and this is a little bit of a limitation of Do Yesharim, is that Do Yesharim was set up, it's great for Ashkenazim, because it tests those diseases which in Ashkenazim are prevalent enough, there's 1 in 100 carriers. For example, blooms, there's 1 in 100 people that are carriers of blooms. So anything that's above a bed, I think it's 1 in 100 carriers, which will give you about 1 in 2,500 ill, is that's what they're going to check. But if you come from Iraq, that isn't a relevant genetic disease for you. But the same way there are Iraqi genetic diseases, which are prevalent, for example, in Moroccan communities, we see things that are prevalent, which are not prevalent in the Ashkenazi community. So Doi Sharim took a statistic and checked out, these are the things that are appropriate for our Ukhlusiyya, which is mostly Ashkenazi Jews. So if you have a high percentage of Moroccan Jews, very possibly that the genetic disorders they have are just not being checked there. So what do we do for those people? So there is a sort of talk of having a Sephardi sort of equivalent Doi Sharim. For many of those people, we send them to genetic testing. I go not to Doi Sharim, which you get a number, it's a secret code, but they're going to go to a lab and then they'll get an answer. Either you're a carrier or you're not a carrier. Now the problem with that, we're going to see in a moment the halachot, particularly the tshuva of Rav Moshe, the problem with that is that being a carrier has no relevance. Zero. But being a carrier has a sort of stigma attached to it. People think, oh, he's a carrier. That's a family we don't want to marry into, because we shouldn't marry, you know, Mishpacha de Matzoraim. But here they're not Mishpacha de Matzoraim. Here they're a carrier. It's very possible that some of us sitting here, all of us sitting here, are carriers of some genetic disorder. And in fact, I would go further than that. I'm convinced that most of us are carriers of some genetic disorder. But it doesn't replicate itself. It doesn't express itself. It's a recessive disorder which is irrelevant. And therefore, being a carrier for most people is irrelevant. So what you'll get if you check in the Kupat Holim is you will get a answer, are you a carrier or not? Now for some people that's hard to do with that. So we had a case like that, a very interesting case. A mother calls me up, her daughter is getting engaged to a guy who is in prison. Why is he in prison? He didn't do anything, Chasva Chaliva, you know, bad. But he was arrested in some Hafganah, Gush Katif, Mashu Kazeh, Ken, you know. So he's in prison. The Shabak, the prison authorities, make his life a misery. And everything that they, if they give him one visit, so then they'll take away five other visits. Everything is a problem. Everything they're making his life a misery. So they want to get married and they want to do Doi Sharim. But if they do Doi Sharim, what it'll mean? That means it'll have to, you know, they'll say, we have to get a blood sample out of prison. So the whole prison authorities, Al Khashbon, will take away five prison visits. They won't be able to see his parents for 2 months. So they want to know, you know, how can we do a check without, we want to do Doi Sharim, but we don't want to compromise his, you know, freedom. So I suggested the following. Why don't we check the girl? If she's a carrier, then we need to check him. But if we check her and she's not a carrier of anything, we don't need to check him. But the mother doesn't want her daughter to be checked and find she's a carrier because she doesn't want to have the stigma of being a carrier. So I said to her, go and check and send me the results. And I won't tell the girl what she has. I'll be in touch with the boy in prison. If you have a problem with finding out are you a carrier or not, then have some third party. The Rav will find out if you're a carrier or not, or you'll have a Rav who will be manui on finding out if you're a carrier or not. And then, if you're not a carrier, then gegezon, then we're fine. If you are a carrier, then we'll talk about what the other side needs to check. So that's the concept of a possible alternative method for specific cases in which we need to check specific things which you can't have. Okay. What's the halacha? Yeah.
Well, why in like 1,000 years to such a discrepancy between, let's say, Moroccan Jews and Ashkenazi?
So somewhere, I heard, you know, in Israel there's a thing called Shut SMS. Response on the SMS, I don't think they've made it to America. Maribazak is they actually write a letter and you get a fax. Here is, you know, it's how much can you get text. In your text. It's a text message, it's like, you know, how many words can you get in?
It's too much.
So they now put in, now in the Parashat Shavua, they have text, you know, text Shavua, this the people of Avinair and Rav Shmuel Eliyahu and others. So this Shabbat, somebody asked me a good question. How is it that the Ethiopian Jews are black? And the Moroccan Jews are dark, and the Ashkenazi Jews are light. So Rav Avinair answered, this is his answer, look if it's historically correct. But default his answer was that there are many Gerim that were midgeir into Judaism in those places, and therefore they, you know, they got to have a lot. Once, after they married, then they have to. So That's a tshuva. I guess, let's say it's mistaber. So I guess that those communities went out and they became connected with the general community. The gene pool was enlarged by having gerim. There's somebody claimed that there's a fifth of all Ashkenazi Jews are related from the Khazarim. From the Khazar, right? From the Khazar. From what?
No, I heard that the families of Rashi were like a dominant family.
Right, so there could be that the specific genetic pools that they're, right, they're like Rashi, Khazari, whatever, you know.
The Gemara says that food and environment have effect on people's appearance. Appearance is not such a great
thing. Appearance before, right. Alright, so what the halakhot? So the question that we ask, Tamim Tiyem Hashem Elokecha. Let's not check at all. What is Tamim Tiyem Hashem Elokecha? Says Rashi, Tamim Tiyem Hashem Elokecha, Italech imo betmimut, Tapelo, Velotachku achar titot, Elakol mashiavo elecha kabel betmimut. Ayahova is not to go and have yeter chakira. But since, like, that's TV, our grandparents never did genetic testing, and Zematzav, we shouldn't worry about it at all. And that's really the tshuva that Rav Moshe says, famous tshuva, that Rav Moshe writes about Doi Sharon. And the beginning of Doi Sharon was a huge pachad, that it will cause a scare in the Jewish community. That the community there'll be families that no one want to marry them, because they're psulim, they're mishpachad ha-matzoraim. And so Rav Moshe says, essentially comes out, that since it's easy to check, mikomakom, kivan she'ata na'aseh zeh be'ofen kal livdok, yesh adon she'em abodek et etzmo, hu keskirat einayim lirot ma she'efshar lirot. It's not tamim, it's shigaon. If I can go, if there's something that I can check and it's easy, that's not tamimus. That's beyond tamimus. Lirot ma she'efshar lirot, umikivan she'em chas v'chalon mirad davar kazeh, hu lehorei hayelet tzar gadol ma'ot, since it's easy to check, it's not a pagam in emuna. That we get that question a lot of times. Is it pagam in emuna to go and check genetics? The answer says, Rav Moshe, no, that's something that's done normally. If you don't do it, then that's already shigon. It's reckless. ולכן טוב לפרסם דבר לידי עתונים ואופנים שידעו העולם שעיקר בדיקה כזו. It's good to publicize it, אבל ברור פשוט שצריך לעשות דבר בצנאה שלא ידע הבחור אחד מחברו ובתולה אחד מחברתה. So therefore it should be done, and that's the Jewish term is an incredible revolution in the world, that they give you a number, it's בחסוי, and in this way nobody knows what the other person has, and nobody knows why we should marry this person or marry that person. That's the concept. So it's really באמת a חידוש עצום. So that's a little bit about prenuptial genetic testing, which I think most people, I think, have met, and we heard about it. They have drives here in the school, I guess. Have the school to check the bachurim bachurot. That's the Devar Chashuv Mod. Yes?
The teshuva is posting. Is there a talk of what percentage you said that before?
I think that a 1 in 100 carrier rate is usually what's considered to be sakana. But if there's a specific familial thing, then that's something that should be checked.
I know past number of years, Professor Kamenetsky has not allowed Doi Sharon to test inside the Yeshiva campus. He feels that they have expanded it, maybe. Over-expanded it.
But maybe that's what Moshe said, that it has to be done by Tzinnitz. Maybe not something should be done by...
No. He feels that, these acts are now carried.
The truth is that Doi Sharon are very specific in what they put in. They do test it. They have genetic cancers sitting and they test it. And they think that the seven or eight things that they now test are things that it is within the parameters of something that we would say is matsui. Again, for Ashkenazi Jews, not necessarily for Moroccan Jews, but for Ashkenazi Jews, I think it's matsui.
Okay. So that's the lechatchila.
What do we do b'diavad? B'diavad, we have a couple who are married. I had a question here. Rav Sauer called me up about a year ago with a shayla that he had here. A couple didn't do genetic testing, or did genetic testing and now get married and find they have something that wasn't in the list of things that Doi Sharon does. What is their possibility? And they have a sick child, or they are tested and they find that both of them are carriers of some recessive genetic disorder. They have a 25% chance of having an ill child. Therefore, what do we have now? We have now a new method, relatively new, it's in the past 5 years developed, called PGD,
which stands for preimplantation genetic diagnosis. That's what it's about. Preimplantation genetic diagnosis is a developing art. We're going to see in a moment how it works. And this is really a method that is extremely important in being able to identify numerous genetic disorders which are specific to specific families, etc., which we'll see in a moment, part of the advantage, part of the limitations. How does it work? How does it work as it follows? I don't know why we waited for 1 second. Okay. So here we have, I don't know if you can see that, that's a sperm cell. Plus we take an egg cell. We put them together, we have fertilization. This has to be done what's called in vitro, meaning outside of the body, not in vivo. We can't get, a woman can't get pregnant naturally and then do PGD. It has to be done through an in vitro fertilization. So we're doing in vitro fertilization. We'll have in the lab a fertilized egg, which now has, over a number of days, developed to being a number of cells. This is an 8-cell stage. At the 8-cell stage, we can then remove one cell, and we can take that genetic, inside every single cell is a replica of the genetic material they have in every single cell of your body. So if I want to know the genetic makeup of a person, I can test their blood, I can test the cells that I just took off my cheek here. Like, those cells will have exactly the same genetic makeup of all of the cells of the body. That isn't 100% correct. That isn't 100% true, but in most cases that is the case. And we can take that genetic material and we can amplify it in a process called PCR, in which we take a small genetic material and we replicate it again and again and again. So now we have a lot of genetic material and we can test it and we can see if that genetic disorder exists in that cell, that embryo is ill. And therefore, what will we do? We'll destroy that embryo. And only the embryos that we have tested and do not have the genetic disorder will be then be implanted into the uterus. So again, we do an IVF. Before we implant the cells, therefore it's pre-implantation, we take out one cell, we analyze the DNA, and we only implant the cells which are, they only implant the embryos which are not affected. Okay?
I think you just said everything is everything.
Right, so, but if it's an ill, then it will be ill. If it's... All the cells have the same genetic makeup of all the cells in that embryo. But if this embryo, remember the first slide? This embryo is affected, then all the cells will be affected. This is not 100% true. But if all the cells are healthy, then that's a healthy embryo. That's the idea. So what are the advantages of PGD over other methods? Well, first, we can discover many genetic disorders. If you go, probably the two foremost centers of PGD in the world are in Chicago and in Milwaukee. Chicago is a Jew by the name of Yuri Vilinsky, and in Milwaukee it's a guy by the name of Mark Hughes. If you go onto Hughes' website or onto Vilinsky's website, they have a list of tens, dozens of genetic disorders which you can now discover. Things that are rare genetic disorders can be discovered. The advantage is we don't rely on terminating a pregnancy. What do we have up till now is that if we have a genetic disorder, we have to terminate a pregnancy. We get into the halachas of terminating a pregnancy, which in this form, you know, this is a whole shiur b'fnei atzmo, and I'm sure many of the rabbanim here know the halachas and the diyun and the poskim and the tzitz of Yezer and Rav Moshe's tshuva about that. But here we don't need to rely on that. So as one Rav told me, this is glut. If we rely on the tzitz of Yezer, then we can say that terminating a pregnancy is kosher. This is glut. This doesn't really need to rely on that header at all. It's extremely accurate. So we have a very slow, if you look at genetic testing, if you look at, prenatal testing, testing of amniocentesis, or ultrasound, or CVS, they have quite a high false positive rate. The false positive rate in PGD is negligible. Still, most PGD centers suggest that you still do prenatal testing. But we've signed that the mistake rate is very, very low, and we'll see in a moment why the mistake rate is at all it develops. And it's a developing science, which means we're getting better and better at this. We're getting better at doing at PGD. We're getting better at using the cells. We're getting better at how do we use, when do we exactly take the cells and what can we test for. So this is something that the whole time we're getting better. So it sounds like the perfect solution. What are the limitations of PGD? I don't want to say disadvantages, but the limitations. Any new science has significant limitations. PGD is no different. The first thing is, it requires IVF. So if we have, and I've had couples, that they know they have a pre-existing genetic disorder. For example, a couple came to me. A woman called me up a few years ago from New York, and she has Fragile X. Fragile X is a case in which the X chromosome, we know that men have an X and a Y chromosome, and women have two X chromosomes. In Fragile X, one of the X chromosomes is fragile, is broken. In Hebrew, it's called Ikshavir. It's a broken X, which is probably more true than Fragile X. The children born, the women usually, the females are usually carriers, and the men are usually severely, from mildly to severely affected. So a woman called me up, she has Fragile X, and she wants to get married. So what should she do, and what can they do? So then I was in a shir in New York, and a man came up to the end of the shir and said, "I'm Chaim, and I'm the other half. You know, you spoke to the woman, I'm the other half. So what should I do? Can we get married or not get married?" So if they get married, in the end they did decide to get married, what they're going to do is PGD. Which means that they will not get pregnant ever, naturally, only using IVF. And IVF has its whole question of alohas, question of wasting seeds. It severely limits the number of children they're going to have. Even in Eretz Yisrael, where IVF is funded by the Kupot Holim, unlike it is in any state in America, still limits the number of children you can have. No one's going to do PGD again and again and again and again. It also limits the success rate. The success rate of natural pregnancy is good. Why? What's the chance of getting pregnant every month? What are the chances for a regular couple of getting pregnant every month?
25%.
What? 25%. What's the chance of getting pregnant with the IVF? Also 25%. So why is IVF limit? Because you don't do IVF every single month. A regular conception is something that you can do month after month. So within a year, most couples will get pregnant. Within 6 months, most couples will get pregnant. Whereas IVF is not like that. No one does IVF more than once every couple of months maximum. And the success rate is the same. So we're limiting the number of children they can have. Apart from the fact that we then put in a financial consideration. That in America, you're talking about PGD is somewhere in the region of $30,000. We're talking about IVF and the PGD and the medication. That's, for most people, severely limits the number of children they're going to have. The second... Right, and they're saying it's not always... It's also 25%, so you could do 5 and still not be successful. In doing IVF? We're going to come to that in one second, because that's another limitation. That's my next thing. Cannot be done for all disorders. Why? What we need for every PGD is we need this thing. This is a genetic marker. You know that we have the Genome Project. That means that we have mapped all of the human genes. We've mapped the genes that are correct. But it doesn't mean that we know every single genetic disorder. Especially since the genetic code is layers upon layers. If we can imagine a three-dimensional book in which letters are in sequence, and on top of that, the same letters are now used for a code that is higher, and beyond that is another layer, so the same letter is used in three different places within three different words, that's a little bit makes us understand what DNA is like. So genetic coding is a very, very complex thing. So in order to know about a genetic disorder, you need to know where the marker, you need to know what you're looking for. Today it is becoming more common, especially in Chicago's, in the Shita Valinsky, to do what is called PGS, pre-implantation genetic screening, which means especially for older women or women who were not successful in a number of IVF programs, we'll take the embryos and we'll just do PGD and look for everything. And that's a little bit like finding really a needle in the proverbial haystack. And even if you find it, it doesn't have any significance. We were in Shari Tzedek recently, and one of the embryos is a brilliant thing. They took embryos that had some mild genetic disorder and implanted them and got healthy babies. How come? Because the system of the embryo apparently has some ability for certain genetic disorders to address the disorder and to have what's called a balanced translocation. So that it can be somehow pagum, but it catches up with itself somewhere else. And so it balances itself out. And so you can have perfectly healthy babies from genetically impaired embryos. Since that is the case, if we check every single embryo for every single genetic disease, we won't have any children at all, because every embryo has got some genetic disorder. And so we really need, in order to say what is PGD, a marker. If you, there's a website called OMIM, which is something, human Mendelian inheritance in humans or something, which is, which shows every single genetic disorder. If we know the marker, we don't know the marker. So if you come to an unknown genetic disorder, then you look on OMIM, you look on the website, they'll tell you whether we know the marker or we don't know. If we don't know the marker, we can't do anything. Because if we don't know what we're looking for, we can't find it. Which also, therefore, is relevant to familial disorders. Since there are certain communities in which it was very common to marry within each other, that's related to your question. So since they were married with each other, if you have a very limited gene pool and you are marrying within each other, then the chances that you are replicating a genetic disorder are very, very high. Which may be why in smaller communities, in Ashkenaz, where, as Rav Bransdorfer's son told me the other, recently, he said, in his name of his father, Zatzal, he said that, you know, a Rav in Europe, there were 50 people in his kehillah. How many Edim did he see? How many Shilas did he have in Hilchos Nidah in his entire Rabbanus? Right? So we, who we have larger communities, the chance that we have Shilas are much greater. Let's take that same model. If you have 50 people in your community, and in those days, traveling outside the community to get married to someone else wasn't so common, so people a lot of times got married within the same 50 families in the shtetl. That's who they got married to. And so we have a very limited gene pool. I once spoke, there in certain communities even common for cousins to get married. I once spoke to a couple came to see me, they were a particular Ada, and I said to them, are you cousins? And he looked at me and said, of course, as though, what, you're not your wife's cousin? And I said, well, and the Mikre, no, I'm not. But they thought that I'm somehow something not normal. Of course, everybody, who do you marry? You marry your wife's cousin, you know, you marry your cousins. Yeah, normally, that's also our, of us also had that. So in those communities, there are familial disorders which are specific for a family. In order to find the marker, it's not written in any book, because it's for this family. You need to test their blood, and the parents' blood, and the grandparents' blood, and the sisters', and the... So you need to do a lot of chakira in the families. And often in families, they don't want to do that chakira. And sometimes you don't have. The parents are not alive. The grandparents, there are no grandparents. There are no other siblings. So sometimes we're limited in our ability to find it. And also there are very rare disorders that we just yet haven't found the marker. The marker exists, we just don't know it. There's another limitation which I didn't put in, but I now thought about now, which is that there are some... Sometimes you have what's called a mosaic genetic disorder. Mosaic genetic disorder means, we said that all the cells are the same. Of course, that's not true. Some of the cells you get, they're mosaic. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. So you can do PGD on an egg, look at it and say, hey, this cell is fine, this embryo is fine. Whereas in fact, you might have taken out the one good cell out of that bunch of bad cells, because it's a mosaic. They weren't all affected. And so it's possible, that's why after doing PGD, they usually suggest you do prenatal testing as well. And the other limitation, which I mentioned before, which is that it affects the embryos. Removing of one cell out of an embryo affects the embryo. How does it affect the embryo? The answer is, we don't know. Mark Hughes in Michigan told me, I asked him how does it affect the embryo, he claimed that it's the same effect for the embryo as freezing an embryo. If you take an embryo and freeze it, you destroy some of the cells. He said it's essentially the same thing. We don't see genetic disorders or birth defects out of frozen embryos any more than we do out of fresh embryos. In fact, there was a couple here in Los Angeles who asked me last week that question. We've had embryos frozen for 4 years. They have children and they now have frozen embryos. They're worried, should we use the frozen embryos or not? I said, that's not cool. That's not a chashash. The embryos are healthy. So we don't see it as unhealthy. That was his claim. But we don't really know that that's the case. So you're asking, is it unhealthy? Doing IVF isn't the most healthy thing in the world. And doing PGD on the eggs may, in fact, affect them. So our question is, what do we use PGD for?
And what do we use it not for? Now, if we understand that we can test genetic, we can test any genetic abnormality. Any genetic abnormality means we could test Tay-Sachs, cystic fibrosis, albinism. I have a Talmidah who worked on some of our papers. She was a research student for me and wrote some papers together with her. She has a child who is an albino. Should she do PGD to check whether the next child is not albino? Being albino isn't ill. It's not very nice. But it doesn't make you ill. Yeah, you have a certain propensity because you have light skin. So you're more susceptible to skin cancer, those sort of things. But many people who have light skin are susceptible to the skin cancer. And that's something that we can protect against. You know, if you sit in the Beit Midrash all day, your exposure to sun is very small. So you're probably not going to get, you probably have less chance of getting skin cancer than other people. We can also test for gender. We can test and we can say, I have five boys, I want to have a girl. Or the opposite, I have five girls, I want to have a boy. Is that permitted? So what limit do we say PGD? Hair color, eye color, left-handedness, height. I don't want to have another small child. I want to have a big child now. So can we get out, you know, or what about... What?
You find that out.
If anything, it's a genetic thing, if we can prove. What about, you know, all sorts of other things, kleptomania, homosexuality. If we can prove there's a gene that turns that on and off, can we do PGD to check out that gene? At what point, at what limit do we say it's the limit? And that's a huge question for PGD. And that really relates to the halachic use of PGD.
PGD has to do with IV, it has to be done through IVF anyway.
Correct.
So if we're Bekoshi being mother, IGF or IVF, most many Paiskim say that they severely limit it, and not go for period really, etc. Of course these things we can.
But what about a couple who are already doing IVF? A couple need to do IVF anyway. And they're saying, if already we're doing it, let's do PGD and so cut out, then we'll have a child who'll be tall.
So what should be the problem with that?
What?
What should be the problem?
Is that, let's say they want to do gender. Is that okay?
I'm asking what it's talking about.
The Shayla, is it Mutah? Well, let's see the halachas. Let's see what he says. So, we know the Gemara.
Maybe that goes into Tamim
Tiyam. Oh, that's the Gemara. So, let's see the Gemara. Gemara says, Rapo Yerape, Mikash Nitan Rashud L'Rafe L'Rapot, says Rashi Nitan Rafut L'Rafe L'Rapot, Velo Amrinan Rahmana, Machi Ve'u Masi. The Kadosh Baruch Hu gave you the Machala, and he'll give you the Trufa. Kadosh Baruch Hu will do that. That we don't say, and therefore we give, when we have a illness, we give trufa. Says Rav Yosef, so therefore if it is therapeutic PGD, PGD that comes to heal, that's mutter. But PGD that is cosmetic PGD, that is asr. That's very nice, but we didn't yet define what's therapeutic and what's cosmetic. For one person, being an albino is therapeutic. For another, it's cosmetic. For one person, being one gender is cosmetic. Whereas for another, that's therapeutic. I had a woman who called me in this area who has three children of the same gender. When she had her second child of that gender, she went into severe postpartum depression because she strongly desired a child of the other gender. When she had her third, she said, that's it, I'm never going to have any more children again. Unless I can have a child of the other gender. So for her, is that already stops being cosmetic and becomes therapeutic and loida? You know, those are the same.
Those are through a VU factor. Let's say they can only have one more child or something.
Right, so then it becomes a question, not only is it a heter, is it a choiva, maybe, right?
Maybe she shouldn't have more children.
What, because she's...
Just waiting.
Huh? Rabbi Yashiv. Yeah, we heard it from him.
But this with Rabbi Yashiv is after how to get the Zera, no? Isn't that a whole big thing by him, how to get the Zera in the first place?
So, once you get to, once again, with Matir, IVF, since it's something that we can prove that you need to have it. If it's therapeutic... That's not a pegamim tamim. If it's not therapeutic. That's a shilag. What?
The Shmuel is the Rav Yashiv is
Bichlal against IVF because he feels he was full.
It seems Bisman Acharon that Rav Yosef is more makel on IVF than he was Bavar. That's what I hear from Talmidim.
No, but because one of the newer chashashot is that he thinks there is always, you know, cross contamination.
No, we're talking about doing it with supervision. That's vaday. I was going to speak about supervision in the second half. Im kvar elenu, the rabbanim should know. Every single rav here should know that supervision is available in Los Angeles, and therefore is vaday echova. En shum sheila. Every couple that comes to you that is doing semen freezing, IUI, IVF, and anything beyond that, vaday needs to order. It needs to order supervision. I have pamphlets at the front, I'm sorry to think of mouth just because of the balagan. It says he had to order supervision. Anybody wants more pamphlets to put in their shul and their mikveh around, is it? Bevakasha. We have, you know, can call up Mrs. Goldstein here in the town, she has extra pamphlets. Vadai chovah to have supervision. So that we got beyond that. You know, the chashash of Rav Sitzelieta that it was going to be a hefkerus, that's vadai we got beyond that. Yeah.
No, he feels that even with supervision, the words that I hear, the only way is if it's clinically sterile. You know, you gotta sterile the chairs and this, because he heard whatever ages from experts that, you know, when if the person touches the table and then the next time you touch the table, there could
be. I sat next to Rav Yosef Vishadito Veloshematikach. When I heard from him that he said his mutam, that, you know, Dibon knows it. So I Loshematikach. So that's with regards to doing PGD. Okay. So then we're left, the other question is, can we destroy the embryos? So okay, the embryos that we want, we put in. But we're left with embryos that we now don't want, and we're going to destroy. So I think that most of the people in the room know. The Mishnah says that Mapelet liyom arbaim eneh hosheshet levalad. And the Gemara explains why eneh hosheshet levalad, but kohen she nesed Yisrael omeit. Tovelet v'ochelet b'truma la'erev. Amar Rav Chisda, tovelet v'ochelet ad arba'im. De'i lo me'abra, ha lo me'abra. V'me'abra, and if she wasn't pregnant, she's not pregnant. If she is, ad arba'im yom maya ba'almahu. Until you arba'im yom, it's called maya ba'alma. It's not called life, it's shum davar. And therefore, Rav Zilberstein wrote in Asiya, a Torah asra lishpoch dam ha'adam ha'nimsa ba'adam. That's the pasuk. Shafech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech. Kuvar b'sefer b'reshit. Shafech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech. Hakavana l'chaye uban imsa ba'adam. That's talking about life that's in a person. Kolomah berechim imo. Aval lo b'yoto adayin b'mavchena. If it's still in the test tube, it still hasn't been implanted, that's not called dam ha'adam ba'adam. And therefore it's mutar. And therefore, Rova Poskim will matir to destroy embryos that are unwanted, unused, especially these that are ill, and therefore we don't really have any use for them. Therefore, most poskim would allow them to be destroyed.
The 40 days is not the issue, because the Ramban writes that it's for under 40 days.
So that's what Rav Zilberstein said. It's only that it's ex vivo. It's not in the body. If it's in the body, vaday, then that's called chayim, because there's a continuum of life. Which maybe starts on day arba'im, but continues from conception. So we don't cut the arba'im and say, when it's mapelet, when it's outside of the body, that's not good, that's my balma, that's the horror, that's the analogy. Okay, so that's with regards to PGD. In Asiya, Sefer Asiya. Chelek Zion, I think.
Is the issue of out of the body nege after the 40, or that's only ahead of the 40?
We have no case today where we are able to grow an embryo outside of the body beyond 6 or 7 days. We can freeze it, but the point of freezing the horror, that's not the continuum stop the horror. Yeah, so we don't have a case like that. So the horror that decided didn't appear. Rav Yisraelis writes that how do we determine motherhood, or questions is egg or birth mother. Rav Yisraeli says where the egg is on day 40. Which today is always the birth mother. The question will come when we're able to grow the egg until, you know, the 80th day. Then the shayla will be. So maybe the egg that's grown in the mafena on day 40 is outside of the body, has no mother. Allah declares motherless according to that shita. We don't hold like that, but it's in the shita. Yes.
Wait,
I'm sorry.
You think it's
yes.
When IVF becomes more successful, what's the percentage now? 30%?
Yeah.
5%? But if it ever reaches 50%, then he, Rav Vosner felt, then the status of the embryo ex vivo would take a change, because then you could, then you can't say that the potential for life is negligible. So he writes, Rav Vosner writes, in sort of dealing with this issue, it's a machlokas between Rav Vosner, who says like this, that you look at the percentage, and those that say it's totally on being in utero or not. Has anybody ever reckoned with that?
This seems right? A little strange, I'll tell you why, because we have millions of embryos around the world that no one is ever going to use. If we hatched all of the frozen embryos, we would populate several cities. We would need several new cities in the world to populate them. So it doesn't seem, just as far, just on a svara, you know, basis, because it's embryos is a svara. It's not, he doesn't write it as a loche. It's a svara. So on a svara basis, it seems that the question of success or not of IVF is a little bit not, it doesn't seem to pan with the makoros that we know of how do we define life, the beginning of life. That's what the mission says, mapelet yom albeim. So let's say 50% of the women mapelet, does that change the mitzvah? Not really. Also, there are clinics that are getting 50%. So in those clinics, the frozen embryos there are like, that's a shayla. I would have a problem with saying that as a definition. It's a manian. I don't think he says it aloha. I think it's sort of okay. So that's PGD. The next place where we find genetics is a little experimental today, but it will not become so experimental soon. Is the use of stem cells, which is a big thing in this country, because there's a whole question to change Bush's policies about stem cells. Especially California is a big thing. I spoke in California about 5 years ago, and I gave this whole talk about something. And at the end, they said, "Very nice, but." What do you think of it? Was it Policy 52 or something? There was some change they were going to make in the Californian law to use stem cells. That was all they cared about. The rest is irrelevant. Must have thumbed up the affair, but you know that we don't want to hear about. We want to hear about stem cells. Which maybe Obama's trying to change a little bit the use of stem cells. What are stem cells? We use this name. What are they? So stem cells essentially are the basic undifferentiated cells that develop to be all the cells that are in the body. If we can imagine a block of Lego, you know, not the Lego now that's, you know, you already buy it, it's already a man or a car or a plane, but the old Lego that we had when we were children, it was what we would call omnipotent. It could be anything. It could become a house, it could become a person, it could become an animal, it could become a plane. There are cells in a body which are omnipotent. They could be anything. They are undifferentiated. They are the basic cells of the body. What happens is that we have basic, and here, embryonic cells, which are basically omnipotent. And as a process, a biochemical process, you can't see this picture cell. What happens is that biochemical processes in the development of the child cause different cells to develop into different types of organism. We said that all the genes are the same. The genes of bone and the genes of blood are the same. What's different is that they've grown, they've been strained, they've been differentiated into different cells. And so these basic pluripotent or omnipotent cells have become unipotent. They've become one thing. They can become one type of cell. And that's how we get, you know, human body. The human body is constructed that we have skin cells and we have blood cells and we have muscle cells and we have bone cells, and all of those were the same cell which have developed into being different things. If we can go back to the stem cell and we can get strains of stem cells, and we know how to do those processes which create those different types of cells, we can create blood cells and bone cells and muscle cells. And so what we can do, right, with the use of the stem cells, is that we can exchange damaged cells. So for example, if we have a heart cell, right? If we have a heart that is damaged, someone has a hole in the heart, And so we can take embryonic stem cells, we will strain them, we'll differentiate them to become heart cells, and we can then transplant them into the heart, and they are heart cells. Right? Which is, it's an incredible thing. As we learn that process, we'll be able to create any cells. Okay? So now, we can clone stem cells. So here's this sad guy, he gives us stem cells. We take out the DNA, and we mix it with other empty cells, and we copy his DNA and grow other cells. So now we can grow lots of his DNA. So we can put a transplant of his heart, which creates a perfect match. What's the problem with transplanting today? If I take one person's heart and put it into another person's heart, even if they're very close match, the body rejects that because it's not a perfect air cell match. It doesn't exactly fit into the hole. But if I can take your stem cells and make your heart cells, the body will never reject that. It's its own cell. Even if we have, you know, monozygotic twins, we have identical twins, they don't always exactly accept the other the other one's organs. But here we have, there's absolutely no rejections. Brilliant. So the future use of stem cells is not only will we mend damaged heart, but we can create a new organ, right? So to heal diseases such as transplanting a pancreas to heal diabetes. Okay, here we have this guy, this bloke has type 2 diabetes, no pancreas, type 1 diabetes, no pancreas, therefore doesn't create insulin. So what we can do today is we can give him insulin shots. He can be on internal insulin shots, but now we don't have it on shots, we have it on a pump. He's on insulin pump. But what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to take embryonic stem cells. We'll be able to differentiate him to make a pancreas. And we will now create a pancreas for this kid. He won't have to have a pump. He will have not insulin. He'll have a pancreas that creates insulin. Right? And any other cell. Right? A person's born with two chambers of the heart. We will create another two chambers of the heart. A person has no eyes. We'll create eyes. And we can do anything. We can do the same process that the body has. That's what stem cells are. Okay? And if we look at it, this is a kind of a small slide for where you're sitting, it would be much better on the screen, but here we see, how do we get stem cells? The best is fertilized eggs. Fertilized egg cells are omnipotent. Means they can be anything. Sorry, totipotent. They can be anything. So embryonic stem cells can be anything. The next stage is a blastocyte. What happens with the embryo is that the cells divide, so they start with 2 and then 4 and then 8 and 16 and 32, and when they become a large genetic mass, at that point we can also take stem cells, and they are pluripotent. It means they can't be anything, but they can be many, many things. So the most is totipotent, and then it becomes pluripotent, and then we can take these cells and they can become lots of other things. So we can take we can create a culture which is a pluripotent stem cell culture. But also we can get stem cells from bone marrow. But the stem cells in bone marrow are not pluripotent, they're the most oglipotent, but they're mostly unipotent. They can become one thing. So they can become other bone marrow, which is amazing. For example, instead of needing a marrow transplant, we can take bone marrow and we can, using stem cells, get you healthy bone marrow. So that's what stem cells are all about, which is really an incredible thing. It's really going to change medicine. It's probably one of the greatest revolutions in our lifetime in medicine will be this. Yes?
We talked about the fertilized egg. That's only one cell.
We can remove, well, as many stem cells as we want.
No, but that's...
No, a fertilized egg starts off with one cell, which then divides into 2.
Exactly.
4, 8...
Will it turn into...
A blasto at 32 cells. 32. So it's about day 5. Okay? So until that time, we can remove cells, which is maybe a good use for all of those frozen embryos that we have sitting around that we don't have any use for. And if we say that we can throw them away, so then maybe we can use them to use the stem cells, and then we could solve a lot of problems that we. But then,
how far
we know a lot of the technology. Why is it not developing? Because in America, it's illegal. The reason mostly that this technology is not developed is because in America it's illegal.
It's not illegal. It's not federal funding.
I think it's illegal. It's not illegal? It's not? Maybe in California it's not illegal. Right. I think it's, isn't it in certain states? It's not in Russia? No. No? It's not federal. Okay. It's not federal funding. It's already enough. There was a letter in Fertility and Sterility recently, about 2 years ago, that said, why are all the good papers not coming out of America? And why are a lot of good papers coming out of India and Singapore? Because there's no government restrictions on what you're allowed to do. So they can do all sorts of wonderful, crazy things that no one would ever do, but actually a good science. It actually might be pushing the world forward.
You go to the public schools if you find a better answer.
Yeah, what?
Go to American public schools.
Maybe. I don't know. You think Singaporean public schools are better? I don't know.
Yeah.
There was a whole story recently. There was a guy in America who to get around the government problem, came up with growing stem cells in Singapore and had this whole program which he published, and then found out that his Singaporean colleagues had actually lied to him and had not created stem cells, and they were actually not, hadn't created stem cells at all, and hadn't cloned stem cells at all, and it was all a lie, and he sort of felt a bit of an idiot, and now spends most of his time traveling around the world to explain why he's not such an idiot as he seems. I saw him in Israel. It was quite a sad lecture. It was quite sad.
Cells. They duplicate them?
We can clone them. You know,
so all you have to have is a couple of cells, and then they can be cloned.
Theoretically,
you just have to give a little bit of a cell.
Theoretically. We can create what's called a stem cell line, which is a production line. Uh-huh. All right, so that's the second thing. Third thing, yes?
What process makes them to be at, unipotent?
It depends at what point of the differentiation process we've got them. So if I've got it right at the beginning, it can be anything. As it gets along, it's differentiated.
The question was, what happens between that fetus that makes the omnipotent into a unipotent cell?
How long do you need on this piece? Because obviously I'll time them a little bit. We're hitting close to
5 minutes.
Yeah, another 5 minutes.
So what happens is it differentiates. There's a biochemical process in which it starts lad becoming something, becoming muscle. As it goes along that differentiation process, it becomes closer and closer to its end product. At that point, we can take it, but it becomes unipotent, not omnipotent. And the last thing we can look at is a question of genetics and cancer. We know that there is, for example, BRCA1 and BRCA2, which are genetic abnormalities which are related to certain types of cancer, particularly ovarian and cervical and breast cancer. Sorry, the gene controls the form. Right? It doesn't matter. Okay, it's dominant mutation. There is a significant increase in the incidence of cancer: 55% for BRCA1, 25% for BRCA2. We'll understand what that means in the next slide. The incidence in the general population of BRCA is 0.5%. In the Ashkenazi population, it's 2.5%. We are 500% more a danger of having BRCA mutation than our non-Jewish neighbors. Without the mutation, the chance of contracting breast cancer is 10%, and ovarian cancer is 1-2%. Now, just understand for a moment what those numbers mean. Breast cancer is a killer, but it's a good prognosis to have breast cancer. Why? Because it's an easy cancer to detect, and it's quite easy for us to treat. It's not pleasant to treat, but it's easy to treat. We can do a mastectomy. We can remove the breast, and we remove the cancer. Ovarian cancer is a very bad cancer to have because it's very, very hard to detect. Mostly, when do we detect ovarian cancer? When we see external bleeding. That external bleeding, also many women who don't keep Ilchot Nidah don't see that anyway. So our women are a little better. But when they see it, that's usually the later stage of development, and ovarian cancer is very, very deadly. But when we have the mutation, the chance of ovarian cancer, of breast cancer is 70%, went from 10 to 70%, 700 times more. And ovarian cancer is 30%. It went from 1% to 30%, 3,000 times more.
Right?
What?
When
you have a mutation, BRCA, they're a little different, BRCA1 and BRCA2, but these are mutations, BRCA. That's the mutation. So the question then is, do we test all Ashkenazi women?
That's the name of the marker?
What?
That's the name of the marker?
BRCA. BRCA? It's called BRCA. So then that's the mark. That's what it's called. It stands for something. So the do we test all Ashkenazi women for BRCA? And then when we test them, what do? So the only thing really we can do is to remove the ovaries. It will affect me. So castrations, it's all from the Torah. The Makoradim probably will know, this is all from the Torah. However, the female castrations are machloket in the Gemara, and also machloket a poskim, whether it's Isur the Rabbanan, like the Ramban the Shulchan Aruch, and the Gra was said that it's Isur Doraita. And most poskim are choshesh to the day of the Gra that it's Isur Doraita. So if we've tested, and you have a higher propensity, it doesn't mean you're ill. It means you have a 3,000% more chance, but it's still only 30%. It's not 50%. You know, it's not going to happen to most women. Most women are still, even if have BRCA, are still going to be okay. So the question then is, do we have a chashash isur doraita in order to save potentially a machala that may happen? Which is a big shayla. Rav Yaakov Ariel asked him, we had a case about removing ovaries. And he said, I am a chosid, I have to be choshesh to the gra. So I said, I'm descended from Talmidei HaGra, kal v'chomer, that I have to be choshesh to the gra. I thought it was a good answer that a chosid realizes that. You have to be choshesh. Rav Asher?
Are you coming to a conclusion at that point?
Yeah.
No, because it happens to be that somebody is unsure that they actually have that.
Okay, so we're going to come to a sheet. I'll come to a conclusion in a moment. There ain't sirus achar sirus beisha. That's vaday. And therefore, if the woman's infertile, then there's no issue to castrate her. So that I heard also from Rav Yosef Befib. I was by him and asked him, and he said that if a woman is infertile, ain't issue to remove the uterus, to a hysterectomy. So we said, I mean, the two ways that we know the woman is post is infertile, which is high FSH, and what's now called AMH, which is a test, a hormonal test of ovarian reserve. So beyond those, if we see that she has a depleted ovarian reserve, which is related to the inability to get pregnant, then she's not going to get pregnant, and therefore we can assume that she's already, you know, mishamaya keradfila. So the oophorectomy, which is removing ovaries, is direct removal of the reproductive organs, which is like the Chazon Ish says, questions, internal organs, external organs, but it definitely is irreversible. But is it a mutar to go for Isur Doraita? Pikuach Nefesh. The Rabbeinu Yerucham. What? And if they go, is it Yoter Kal? The Rabbeinu Yerucham says that mutar lavol Isur Doraita rak kasher sakanan nefashot b'faneinu. We don't have sakanan nefashot b'faneinu. She's not ill. It's a chashash that ba'atid she's going to get the machala. However, we spoke to Rav Bakshi, and Rav Bakshi said, kevan she'asikunu mi'al 50%, right? We said a 70% chance of getting breast cancer. Zeh nechshav kilu ha'sakana lefaneinu v'lachen mutar likrot et ha'shachalot. But since we say that there is a much higher incidence, he said that's called sakana lefaneinu. Even though she's not ill, that's like Rav Brander said, even though she's not ill, since the chashash is so great, that's called sakana lefaneinu. And therefore he would say, in that case, it is, it's mutar.
What?
That's
not going to help for the ovarian, which is a good question.
No, for the ovarian, he's saying.
But that's only 30%.
So only 30%, the question is again, you know,
have
50%. Only 30%. I mean, he's saying that it's something I would say that's matsui. Something that's matsui is called lefaneinu. If you say that it's not matsui, it's not lefaneinu. Something that's matsui, I think that was the number that he gave, 50%. Yecholiyot, we would say, in certain types of BRCA, the chashash is even greater than 30%. So yeah, so if a woman comes and says, in my familial situation, the doctor is saying, I got a 60% chance of getting, then vaday, you would say, that's sakana lefaneinu.
How do they find out that they have it?
So how do you find that they have it? It often comes with a woman who has family, you know, a mother got, and so she comes to be tested, and when they tested, they saw that she has this mutation. And it's common, it's an uncommon thing. So, should we test everybody? Shela tova. But if you have a woman in your community who had family, who, you know, mother who had, grandmother who had ovarian cancer, then she should be tested. There's a huge chance that she has that mutation. And then the question is, what do we do with that? What is her chances of getting it?
Is it possible to get ovarian cancer without that?
Yes. There are women who will have ovarian cancer who don't have. You're saying there's still a chance, there's a 1% to 2% chance of everybody in the whole population getting ovarian cancer. If a woman has BRCA, she now goes into a much higher risk rate. But there are women, 1% to 2% of women, who will get ovarian cancer without ever having any mutation. So you're not everything, which is related a little bit to the next thing, which is genetics isn't everything.
Well, they just take out the shahala, but this woman, can she take out embryos and still do IVF?
Could she take out?
Or, let's say they remove the shahala, could she still...
She can. Well, maybe we'll look at that a little bit in the next session, which is talking about... We'll speak about hysterectomy and partial hysterectomy. We'll speak a little bit about that. We always say to the tzibur, and I think it's important for us to, you know, the fear is that genetics is not everything. Even though we are products of our genetics and everything, and we know that we have free will, we have nature versus nurture, and the Rambam writes that a person has, you know, b'chira chofshit b'yado, to decide what he wants to do. And Lefum Sara Agra says the Sefer Or Zarua, Perush Adam sh'tarach b'torah, kol ma sh'ei yachol l'troch, Avo b'shelo yala b'edo, person that learns Torah, even though he wasn't successful, the question is the fiha torah, not the fiha, you know, the totzot. According to our effort that we put in, that's what we're going to get out. So the fact that we have a genetic propensity, or that, you know, today we blame genes for all sorts of, you know, things that we have. We mentioned before kleptomania and homosexuality, all sorts of other things. We love to blame genes. You have to understand that genes are not everything. Even if you have a genetic propensity to something, that doesn't mean that everybody has a genetic propensity to be a kleptomaniac is going to break into stores and steal. A person has to also work on themselves, has a tshuva, in order to have a reshut natan biyado to be to lachzor b'tshuva. That's
it.
Oh, that's an excellent question. Is that where if a woman has BRCA, does she have to send shiduchim?
But what about other cancer, types of cancer?
She has, or there is in the family?
The members of the family has cancer.
What we have to look at is whether all cancers are familial. Not all cancers are familial, are connected to a family propensity. Some of them are, and some of them are not. And therefore, when we look at a cancer, you can't say cancer, because cancer is cancer. You know, Hodgkin's is not familial. Ovarian cancer usually is. So it depends what cancer you have.
They could tell us 100% it is or it's not, the doctors.
You can't say 100%, but there is certainly a familial propensity to a particular cancer is a question. But you have to say in shiduchim, that's a whole genetic, that's a whole, shiduchim is a whole shiur b'fnei atzmo. Maybe next year we'll do this first.
What's the ovarian cancer you said that Ashkenazim is presented as far as well?
For the number of Ashkenazim who have BRCA mutation is 500 times more than the general population.
That's
for
Sephardim,
it's
500%.
500%.
500%.
500%.
5 times more, 500%.
500% more, yes. Right, 500 times, right. 500% more. But in the Sephardim, it's less.
Do we know any reasons for that? Why
we spoke about that there are genetic, there's small genetic gene pools, and so we managed to pass over a specific gene pool. Because the question is, if we hold, like the Catholics, that stem cells is the beginning of life, destroying an embryo is a sore. Especially at a blastocyst stage. There are certain Christian sects that say that a blastocyst, since it's already started differentiating, is already a human being. Because there we have a differentiation between the cells that will end up as being placenta and cells that will end up as being baby. And so at that stage, already say, that's vadai, a human being. We don't hold like that. That was Bush's hitnagdut stem cells. He said it's human life. We don't hold that it's human life.
And why can't they use the placenta?
Why can we use placenta as stem cells?
Or something at birth. I don't have...
One of the good sources of stem cells is... the cord blood. Amniotic cord blood is good source of stem cells. It's not omnipotent. It can't be everything. It's pluripotent. It can't be everything. Uh-huh. So but that is a good set. That's why it's a chashuv to store that blood.
Would you pay for it? Would you be worth paying that?
It's expensive. It's not how much does it cost in this country?
Every month you have to pay a fee.
Yeah.
$800 to begin with and $40-$50 a month or something.
The question you have to ask is how much of that can we use? How many of the things do we actually know how to use? Just to show that. A lot of it we're storing for maybe, you know, in 20 years' time we'll know the technology. Just to show that if an answer. One of the Rabbanim in the Mahon wrote an article in Tchumen, whether you can use it on Shabbat, when you can do it on Shabbat. Whole question of Saddam and Kshiran.
Where do men get those?
What? From there. Also from there. I mean, everybody has amniotic stem cells at some point. We all lose them.
Because
yes. Can I go?